You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
In 2003, Abu Sufyan Abdulrazak traveled from Montreal to Sudan to visit his ailing mother. Once there, he was arrested and imprisoned. The Canadian Federal Court later concluded that this arrest probably took place at the request of Canada's spy agency, CSIS. During two periods of detention, Mr. Abdulrazak was beaten, threatened, and tortured. He was also interrogated by CSIS officials, but he was never charged. Following his release in 2006, Mr. Abdulrazak tried to return to Canada. His Canadian passport had expired while he was in prison, so he needed a travel document. But the Canadian government consistently refused to issue one to him, even though he had been cleared of all suspicion by CSIS and by the RCMP. In 2008, Mr. Abdulrazak claimed refuge in the Canadian embassy in the Sudan. He lived in the embassy in Khartoum for 14 months until a federal court order forced the Canadian government to bring him back to Canada. Mr. Abdulrazak has been back in Canada for 17 months, but he is still unable to work or to manage or access his money. That's because his name is on the United Nations 1267 list of suspected terrorists. Mr. Abdulrazak and Mary Foster with Project Fly Home were in Vancouver last week on the final stop of a cross-Canada tour. We recorded the event at the Maritime Labour Centre, and we're going to hear first from Mr. Abdulrazak. He starts his story in Montreal, where he first became the target of a CSIS investigation.
Good evening, everyone. As usual, I start my story with a word, مخابرات, which is, in my language, Arabic. It means the security agents. But for me, and everybody came from Arab state or Muslim state, it has different meaning. It means long time in the prison without no charge. In some cases, death. And sometimes people disappear forever and their family, they can never find single information about them. In torture. After September 11th, CSIS harassed me and my family. And even CSIS tried to buy my wife. They bargained with her for information to give them about me and to give her money, or if she wants better treatment for her cancer, they could do it for her. After some months, my wife, she was passed away. Also, I received news from my family that my mother, she was sick. Now, I'm between three difficult points. Lost of my wife, my mother, she was sick in my country. And like I mentioned before, CSIS followed me everywhere, and sometimes in front of my apartment building. Morning and night, I find a car stopped in front of the building. It's waiting for me to get out from my apartment, and then they follow me everywhere I go. I decided to go to Sudan at that time. I went to Sudan. And before I went to Sudan, a few days before, two CSIS agents came to my house and they asked me about my belonging to travel abroad. And then just I said to them, this is a personal matter. I don't want to tell you. Leave me alone. And then when they insist and pushed hard just like to find out where am I traveling, I went back to my apartment and I called the city police for them. The police arrived in the parking area and they asked them to leave me. While they were walking away from me, one of them, he turned his face to me and he said, we know that you're going to Sudan and you will see. I went to Sudan. I arrived there, took care of my mother. I gave her support. And I visited some people from my family in different parts in Sudan. And then when I planned just to come back to Canada, I received a call from somebody claimed that he came from Saudi Arabia. And he mentioned the name of my nephew. And he said, my nephew sent a letter with him to me. I went to this person in one place in Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan. And when I arrived there, I found a surprise waiting for me. It is a Sudanese intelligence agent. They said to me, Abdurazik, we need, after they introduced themselves to me, then they said to me, they want to talk for 15 minutes and then will bring me back. As I mentioned before in the beginning of this talk, mukhabarat, it is very ugly and scary word for everybody who came from my area. Then I start to panic and I became very scared because I don't want to deal with this kind of thing. Then one of them, he said, when I'm panicking, yes, why? Why should I go with you? What wrong I did? I asked him a question. He said, Abdurazik, we have authorization. If you don't go with us, we will shoot you. Yes, I more become afraid. And just, I say, no, why? What is the reason? This? And then one of them, he pulled the gun and pointed to me. And he asked me to go on the ground. And this is in the street, public street, the people walking around. Just because for me, it's a serious matter. Yes, I went down. They pulled me from my hand and pushed me in a car and drove away. When we arrived at the Sudanese intelligence headquarters, they put me in a cell, 2.5 meters by 1.5 meters, with only a pillow. They threw it on the ground. They locked the door and turned the air condition on. And the cell is very small. After 1 hour, a few times, the cell has become very cold. And just sitting down there, and I'm thinking, and I'm frightened, and just I imagine everything bad is happening in that moment. Anyway, I spent 12 days, nobody asked me nothing. Just imagine, in this small cell, it's very cold, and just to let you with your guests, with this unknown situation, what will end? I think about my children, about my life, about what wrong I did. You know, my brain is worked like crazy in crazy way. By the day 12, midnight, the door is open, and the two agents, the same two agents, entered the room, and they asked me to sit down. Actually, in that cell, there is a desk. Maybe it's just like that. There is two chairs and one chair in front of the desk. They asked me to sit down in front, the chair in front, and then the two agents, they sat down behind the desk. And one of them, he opened the drawer and looked at it inside the drawer and asked me questions. The old questions about people from Montreal and other names I've never heard about them before. What I know about these guys in Montreal, I answered. What I don't know, of course, I'm not going to survive and put other people in trouble. But these guys, when they heed what they hear, the opposite of exactly what they want, they slap me and to push my head against the wall, spit on my face, and insulting me with very bad words. The interrogation took like between 5 and 7 days. And then I've been transferred to a prison called Cobar. May you not know Cobar, but the government of Canada have full knowledge of that prison because so many people from Darfur, from south of Sudan, being tortured in that prison, and the United Nations have full knowledge also about that prison because a place of torture. I spent some time in that prison for certain reason, I don't know. They transferred me back to the Sudanese intelligence headquarters. In October 2003, one night, the same two agents came to my cell and called my name. When I went outside, just when they called my name, I imagined everything is over and now I could go back to Canada. But when I stepped out from the cell, one of them, he said to me, Abdulrazik, you have a visitor from Canada. Say, who? He said, you have some friend came from Canada, they want to talk to you. In the company of these two agents, I went with them to an hall. In the middle of that hall, there is long tables full of cake and drink, coffee, juice, whatever. And the two friends visited me, the same two CSIS agents who came to my apartment to Montreal before I left to Sudan. They're sitting down there because I knew these guys. Just I say hi. One of them, he said, "You remember when we came to your home in Montreal? And we said to you, you will see. Now you will see." They asked me the same questions as the Sudanese asked me. See. The interrogation is continuous for 2 days. The last day of the interrogation, just I asked them to help me out to go back to Canada. And I said to them, if you have something against me, I'm willing to go back to Canada and to face any kind of charges laid against me. One of them, he said, "We are not going to help a terrorist man. You are not Canadian. You are a Sudanese." Said, "Look, if you are not confident in the Canadian justice system, I will go with you anywhere it satisfied you. And even the worst place in the planet now, Guantanamo Bay, I'm willing, just in one condition, treat me unjust." The man, he said, "Look, Sudan, it will be your Guantanamo." And he finished like that. After CSIS agents visit, 1 month or 2 months, I'm not sure, two guys escaped from the prison, from my cell. And then, after these two guys escaped the prison, the treatment has become very harsh and very bad, like beating with the rubber hose everywhere, sometimes midnight, sometimes 2 o'clock in the morning, just you find the soldiers enter the cell and to be asleep or wake, just to beat you up without any reasons, slapping and kicks, and tied the hands and tied on the door frames for several hours to be standing up and your hand like that, and sometimes several hours against the wall to stand up. It's been in this situation up to April 2004. I asked the Sudanese secret police for a lawyer, and they said to me, "There is no lawyer here." I asked for trial. There is no court. I asked them then, "What is the reason?" They told me they don't know the reasons for my detention. I look everywhere. Yes, I'm really isolated from the outside world. And I just look any kind of means just to get out from these problems. The only way to go on hunger strike. I did it 3 times. I failed in 2 because the Sudanese secret police beat me up and pushed me just to stop the hunger strike. But the third one, I handled it, and just I continue with everything. And I successfully, they transferred me to other place. to there, there is little bit room of yes, I get rid of the torture for little bit, but the torture is there. I saw some people, a man in 74 years old, they hang him in the ladder, his leg untouched the ground, and hanging him all the night and beat him up all the night. For me, yes, they didn't do it, but for other people, I saw it and this kind of torture too. To see a man 74 years old, he's half a blood pressure, diabetes, and to be hung all the night, and young men just slapping him and beat him, and he screaming like crazy, you know. This kind of torture, to see this kind of scenes. July 2004, the Canadian embassy in Sudan made reservation with Lufthansa for me to come back to Canada. But in the same day I supposed to come back to Canada, I've been informed by the consular that my name is being added to no fly list, which is belong to United States, and Lufthansa refused to allow me to fly with them. I wait for three days after, and then the consular informed me that the Canadian government could do nothing for me if I find a way to make reservation for myself. Then they will issue my travel documents because my passport is being expired and they refused to renew it for me. After that, yes, I struggled to come back, but all the time I find my ways blocked. In 2004, August, I've been released under condition to be within the city, not to go out of the city of Khartoum, and to sign every Thursday. And I've been watched by the Sudanese secret police. Everywhere I go, they followed me. November 2005, I received a call from the Sudanese secret police. They claimed that they received documents from Canada on my behalf, and they asked me to come down to take those documents. In my head, just I said, this is another trick. Why should I go to them? At that time, I've never imagined the Canadian government involved in my trouble. Just I thought to go to the Canadian embassy and to seek help there. I went and I met with Alan Bones, who's the head mission in Khartoum. And I informed him, but he said, Abdurazik, the boss country is Sudan and Canada. They have nothing against you. Just go see these people and maybe they are right, maybe. But I said to him, why these documents not to come to Canadian embassy? Why it could go there? He said, I don't know. Just go and we're going to follow with you by the telephone. And he convinced me to go. I went. When I arrived in the receptions of the Sudanese secret police, I entered the reception, just I asked about my documents. Then when I see somebody come to me and said, okay, come out. I went out, I find a car in front of the reception door with three men with machine guns. And they opened the door of the car. They asked me to go inside the car. I went and drove inside the Sudanese intelligence headquarters. And they informed me that I am under arrest. This is second time. Yes, I tried to call the ambassador, and I start the conversation with him. I said, look, they arrest me now again. And then they took the cell phone from me. And they transferred me to other well-known knowledge for the Canadian government. A prison is called Dabak. This for somebody to be isolated completely and forgotten. It's they bring the people there in that prison. I spent 9 months in that prison without single question, without nothing, without, I don't know why they arrested me in that second detention. Unless in the beginning, when I asked them in the car, the officer, he said, the CIA came across Sudan and they asked them to arrest me. In these 9 months, the same treatment without no reason. Beating with the rubber hose, kick, slapping, and bad words, standing for several hours against the wall. In this second time, detention, I became sick with the malaria and typhoid and depression. The typhoid is make the person like crazy, you know. All this combination, malaria and typhoid and depression, it's not funny things, you know. Instead to receive medical care, what I received, they put me on metal bed and they put 6 kilos, ring of 6 kilos each leg, and handcuff attached with the chin, my leg to my hand, and they tied me up on that bed because my movement with the typhoid and the depression is like crazy, too much movement. And when I scream or express myself, slobbing and push me hard on the bed. And I spent a while when they saw my situation is getting worse, then maybe after 1 week or 10 days, then they brought me to the hospital. In 2006, I finished this second term of detention. I've been released from the prison, and the Sudanese cleared my name completely because they find nothing after all this beating and bad stuff. They find nothing, actually. In 2006, the FBI came to Sudan to interrogate me. Before I meet with the FBI, I went to the Canadian embassy again. And I asked the consular support. I asked him to come with me to attend the FBI meeting. But when I came the next day, because he said to me, he's going to go back to Ottawa and to see what advice they're going to give to him, to go with me or not. When I came next day to him, he said, Abdurazik, sorry, I cannot go with you. Go to the FBI by yourself. I went to the FBI meeting in the Sudanese intelligence headquarters. And one of the three agents, there is two agents and one somebody to translate for me. And the first thing he said, the FBI agent, he said, Abdurazik, the door is open widely for you to go back to Canada. And if you want money, we will give you money. Just to work with us. I said to him, I am a machinist. Do you have a job for me as a machinist? He said, no, not that. I said, what? He said, when we bring you back to Canada, just go to the mosques and the Muslim community in Montreal and give some reports, just write some reports to us. about the community. And if we need to bring you to Afghanistan or Iraq, you can do it. Then my reply to him, I say, if I don't want to work with you. One of them, he's with big muscles, and he say, look, if you don't work with us, you're going to be in the state of Khartoum homeless forever. We forbid you to work. Then I said to him, look, I'm not going to work with you. Then he finished like that. I went back to the Canadian embassy after FBI meeting. Immediately after I get out from the Sudanese intelligence headquarters, I hit the Canadian embassy and I said to the consular, the FBI asked me to work with them. Then in this 2006, in the same year, the consular, one morning he called me and asked me to come over. When I went there, he informed me that my name is being added to a list of, which is 1267 list, which is belong to United Nations. And he informed me that my possibility to go back to Canada is become more difficult. I don't have no knowledge about the list. For me, at that time, it is something take like 1 month, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, and it's over. But not, that is not the case. In 2008, I struggled. Just even he informed me, he told me about the 1267. I try hard just to come back. But all the time I've been blocked because the Canadian government don't want. 2008, I received call again from the Canadian embassy. They asked me to come over again because there is a people from the Canadian government want to talk to me. And by the way, from 2004 up 2009, I saw many Canadian officials. I met with them in the Canadian embassy. And just, they lied to me. And they called me down. And they said, Abdulraz, when I asked them, because I'm just struggled to come back, I asked them to help me. They said, oh, Abdulraz, everybody knows I was working hard on this case. Sure, you're going to go back home. But slide, including the former Prime Minister Paul Martin. In 2008, the former Foreign Affairs Minister Maxime Barnier, he visited Sudan with Deepak Oberoi, and the telephone call I received in 2008 to come to talk to official came from Canada. It is Deepak Oberoi, who came with Maxime Barnier. I went to the Canadian embassy in the whole meeting, myself and the consular, Eric O'Connor, his name, and Deepak Oberoi, and somebody else. Four of us in that room, and Deepak Oberoi, I don't know if he's RCMP or politician or CSIS, I don't know, because he interrogated me, that guy. Instead to help me as a Canadian citizen, he asked me 3 questions, and to answer his questions, it is a door to help me. If not, he cannot help me. That's exactly what he said to me. He said, Abdulrazik, if you don't answer my questions, I cannot help you. And then his questions, not about the same guys, which is CSIS and FBI and the Sudanese asked me and the French. But he asked me, Abdurazik, what do you say about Israel? What do you say about Hamas, Osama bin Laden, and September 11th? Just put yourself in my place. You need help. And this is the people who can help you. Of course, I gave him my own opinion on his questions. But he ended the meeting like that. And I followed him and I said, look, I need help. Guess I won't go back to Canada. Then he turned back to me and said, Abdurazik, is your name on the list of 1267. When you remove yourself from that list, we will help you. In 2008, about 1 month from that meeting, my lawyer here in Ottawa, we discussed through the telephone because we want to go with the story publicly. And me, I afraid to be in the state of Khartoum and to be rearrested for the third time. Yes, we find the best way that I go to stay in the Canadian embassy for protection. I went there and I spent 14 months in a place 3,000 meters with whole camera in different places and various, it is a small place, you know, just with cameras and with a lot of pressure. This man, Eric O'Connor, the counselor, he pushed me hard just to go out and to get rid of me. And sometimes because he's very ill treatment, I'm really just sometimes I think just to go and what will happen to me in the street. It is because I'm get fed up, you know, just mentally is torturing mentally in severe way. But sometimes when I reach a point that I want to quit, I receive letter from people from Canada, from different provinces, different villages, different cities. When I received those letters, they give me power and support to continue through that difficulties. 14 months. The way I came back to Canada, because my lawyer brought my case to the federal court, and then the federal court enforced the Canadian government to bring me back. I came back in June 27, 2009. Physically, I arrived in Canada, but I am still in a huge problem. My name is still on the list 1267, which is prevent me to work or to deal with my life financially. And if I want single things, by the remote control, somebody in New York just controlling my life. If I want anything, supposed to go back to New York to ask permission to do the thing for my own life. I can say I am buried alive. My life is frozen completely. I cannot manage myself, my life by myself, as you do. Now, if you want to fly anywhere, you can do it. But me, I can't. If you want to quit your job to change another one, you can't do it. Me, I cannot look for nothing. The purpose of this tour, just to meet with the people, those people who support me and help me out in different ways, and to share my story with you, and just to let all the Canadians across the country to know exactly what is going on. and to stand against this kind of behavior from our politicians and to stop it. Thank you very much.
We've been listening to Abu Sufyan Abdulrazak speaking at the Maritime Labor Center on November 23rd. We're going to hear now from Mary Foster. She's an organizer with Project Fly Home. She describes how the United Nations 1267 list works and the effect that it's had on Mr. Abdulrazak's attempts to pick up the pieces of his life in Canada.
I just wanted to recognize the kind of courage it takes to not just survive and struggle through something like that, but then to speak out against it afterwards. And to do this is, Mr. Abdulrazak used to start his talks by saying, I never thought I would have to speak publicly in my life. And, you know, to nevertheless bring this to everyone's attention, I think is incredibly courageous and inspiring. And I wanted to give a bit more context to the 1267 list. Because we've continued to work since he's been home in Montreal and other places that are working in solidarity with us, because no one's been held responsible for what happened at all. It's not only have there been no apologies, no one has even agreed to meet with him to discuss anything, and it's extremely important that the people who are involved in this be held responsible and that people be made aware of this. Clearly, it's not an isolated case. I think there's been other very well-known cases that have been in the media a lot, such as Mahar Ars and Mr. Al-Malki and Mr. Nuruddin and Mr. Al-Mati, who also all are victims of an outsourcing of torture by Canada and in some of the cases, the United States was also partners with Canada in this. What I really want to focus on now is just giving a bit more information, kind of nitty-gritty information about that 1267 regime, because I think, again, it represents, it's sort of a very obvious case of a political trend that's broader and very important to confront collectively. So the 1267 regime is something that was, it's an international regime, and I think that's an important feature for us to grasp. It's a kind of a solidarity among states to place people like Abdulrazak in this situation. It was established in 1999 by the Security Council. It was brought forward by the United States and accepted by the other members of the Security Council at the United Nations just after the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi were bombed. And that kind of allowed a political opportunity for this to pass through the Security Council. It's unique because it imposes sanctions on individuals. There's been other sanction regimes, obviously, internationally brought by the United Nations. This one names individuals and places them under an international travel ban and a complete asset freeze. So an international travel ban is not, it's not a no-fly list. You can fly. Abdulrazak flew here, but it prevents you from traveling across countries. So, for example, if you're an immigrant, you can't go and visit your family. If someone's ill, that's it. That's not possible at all. So you can't go across borders once you're on this list. And the other thing it does is the asset freeze basically means that you can't have the way it works in Canada is that the effect is an asset freeze on the listed person, but the legislation applies to everyone else. So it would be illegal to give someone on the list some money, including a salary. That's completely illegal. Any financial services are illegal. So, for example, you know, just on a very daily basis, you can't have a bank account. You can't have a any property, obviously, and you can't have a job, because every time you need any money, you would have to go and ask the council, the Security Council, the committee that's responsible for this in New York, for an exemption. So your life is completely managed by these people in New York. Any little access to money that you need would have to go through, your daily living needs goes through to that committee in New York. So obviously that makes it almost impossible to work, because who's going to hire someone when they have to go to New York to ask for an exemption so that they can hire you? So that is what the 1267 list does. I want to just quickly explain how you get on and how you get off the list. It's in a word, it's very easily on and very difficult to get off. It's explicitly a preventive list. So there's no crime that needs to have taken place at all. It's what you may do in the future. There are no criminal charges, it's based on alleged association. So the two elements really are profiling and association. It's about who you are, who you may know, and not what you've done. You are listed by the recommendation of any member of the Security Council. So any state comes with some information, gives it to the Security Council, and you find yourself on the list. There's no mechanism for reviewing that information to make sure it's true or not. There's no information. There's no process for you to respond to anything. In fact, as a listed person, you typically don't know why you're on the list. You may have absolutely no reason given to you why you're on the list. So for the first 3 years, for example, that Abdurazak was on the list, from 2006 to 2009, he was given no information about why he was on the list. He was just on this list. And then in 2009, when he was very much in the media and there was a scandal in Canada, suddenly the United Nations Security Council 1267 Committee posted a small blurb on their website about why he's on the list. And I think it's worth looking at where that information came from and what that information is about. The center of that information says that he is associated with this man, Abu Zubaydah. That's the center part of the accusation against him. So there's all sorts of problems. First of all, association, who cares? You're now all associated with Mr. Abdurazak. I'm very associated with him. And that's enough to get you on this list, association. Secondly, he doesn't know Abu Zubaydah, as it turns out. Thirdly, what it says is that Abdurazak is an associate of Abu Zubaydah, and Abu Zubaydah is a top-ranking official of al-Qaeda. Now, the problem with that is that now the United States has reversed its position and no longer says that Abu Zubaydah had anything to do with al-Qaeda. They are now saying that this guy was not a member, was not an affiliate, didn't necessarily share the ideology of al-Qaeda, and nevertheless, he remains on the list. So he's supposed to be associated to al-Qaeda through this middle person, but now this middle person no longer is supposed to have anything to do with al-Qaeda, but he remains on the list. And that the final problem with this allegation that he's associated with al-Qaeda is that you might have heard Abu Zubaydah's name, and you might have heard it because a lot of the top U.S. officials have talked about him as someone who was subject to strong interrogation techniques. I can't remember exactly how George Bush put it, but he's basically, as the U.S. Justice Department of Justice reported at least once, he was waterboarded severely. He was very severely tortured. So the information that comes from him is obviously not worth anything. And the courts in Canada, this information has been used in several other cases. In a lot of the security certificate cases, Abu Zubaydah's name pops up, and the federal court has basically said we're not going to use any of that information in any courts in Canada because it comes from a torture program and is morally abhorrent and useless as information. And this is the only information that he has about why he's on the list. Not one shred of evidence has been given to substantiate. This is one paragraph. To be delisted, you either can go through your state, which is Canada, in this case, which obviously is not going to work, just from the story that has just been shared with you, or you submit an individual petition to be delisted. What happens with that information is that, again, there's no mechanism for evaluating the information. It's just given to the state parties, and any one state party can say no, and they don't have to give any reasons. So then you're still on the list. And that's indeed what happened. In 2007, he asked his lawyers to ask Canada to take him off the list. Canada, in the context of its deciding whether or not to go to the United Nations to ask to have him delisted, went to its two security agencies, RCMP and CSIS, asked them whether there were any reasons why they shouldn't ask for him to be delisted. And both RCMP and CSIS in 2007 wrote letters saying, we have no information that he's involved in any criminal or terrorist activities. So on the basis of that complete clearance, they went to the Security Council and were told no. And he didn't get a single reason why no. So that was it. So he remains on this list. It's obviously a political regime, and it's based on advancing political interests that have nothing to do with the stated aim of preventing terrorism. Just as a little example, if it's not already completely crystal clear, this past year, of course, the United States has shifted its policies in Afghanistan, now wants to work with members of the Taliban in order to stabilize the situation in Afghanistan. And one barrier to that is that several members of the Taliban, ministers in the Taliban government, in fact, are on this list. So what do they do but just remove them from the list? And so now you have a situation where the people who this is allegedly targeting and trying to control are taken off the list. Whereas Mr. Abdurazak, because it wouldn't be of any strategic political interest to take him off the list at this point, remains on the list. The last thing I want to talk about just quickly before wrapping up is that to make really clear the role of Canada in this, because what Canada keeps doing is saying it's the Security Council, it's the United Nations, our hands are tied. But in fact, it's Canada that's imposing the sanctions. As you know, the United Nations doesn't directly impose sanctions on individuals. It works through its member states. So it's Canada that's imposing the sanctions. It's Canada that has the power tomorrow to lift the sanctions if it wants to. Who could also completely withdraw from this regime and obviously should withdraw from this regime. It's also Canada who would have a diplomatic power and a responsibility to try to get the other members of the Security Council, or the members of the Security Council, to take his name off the list. So it is entirely within Canada's hands to address the immediate situation and lift the sanctions within Canada. It's not Parliament that needs to act, it's the Cabinet that needs to act. Cabinet created these regulations that impose the 1267 regime in Canada, and it's Cabinet which can do just the opposite and lift the sanctions. Abdurazak launched a charter challenge to this piece of legislation that's imposing the sanctions on him in Canada, and that will win. That will eventually win, but it will just take a long time, maybe 3-4 years. There's no question that this is a violation of every law, but it just that sort of wearing people down, sending a message that we can do this kind of thing if we want to, because we have the power to. And then the courts will eventually force the Parliament to look at this again, but they'll probably just come back with another piece of the same legislation unless there's a strong popular movement against it. And that's the only thing that's going to make a difference in this situation, as we've seen in many, many other campaigns. As I mentioned before, Canadian Labour Congress, the Postal Workers Union, Auto Workers, QP, PSAC, the Machinists Union, and some local district labour councils and some locals, local affiliates of those unions, have joined together to create a Just Work Fund. And what they said is, we've seen this before in the labor movement. We've seen these kind of measures and how they hurt workers and how quickly those things can move in a direction where people are paralyzed and can no longer stand up and oppose them. And so what we're going to do is set up a fund, hire Mr. Abdurazak in complete open violation of the sanctions. And so they've done that, and he's now on the Canadian Labour Congress payroll, and that's what's paying for part of the speaking tour and for the speaking. in order to tell his story to other Canadians, to help to try and mobilize Canadians around this and these issues, and at the same time to send a strong signal to the government that the labor movement is not going to put up with the 1267 regime and these kind of blacklists. So I think that's a very important strategy. And just maybe as a final point, when we were coming here, we weren't sure what to expect at the airport. We weren't sure whether or not CSIS or whoever does that kind of thing has put his name on the no-fly list. Well, it turned out they hadn't, and he was able to fly, which shows, again, the inconsistency applying these sanctions, but at the same time, obviously not being serious about them. But they did put him on some kind of watch list, some harassment list. What they have to do is call Transport Canada and get your file deblocked every single time you try to go through the gate. So it's just been a harassment. And then you're subjected to very humiliating searches and have everything gone through, and you're supposed to go through one of those machines that scan you. So all of this is applied every time. And interesting, the last time we tried to fly, they did it to both of us, so we're both on it now. And I think this kind of association obviously is a way of isolating, you know, someone who's on it. You're supposed to be afraid to be associated with. And I was really pleased to see that people in Regina come up afterwards with this idea of an associate in, that they lined up to take their photographs with Abdelrazzak afterwards, as a way of saying, I'm proud to be associated. And I think that's the kind of thing I hope a lot of us can do, because obviously there's just an attempt to isolate people, set them up as an examples and scapegoats of what happens if you're the wrong color, the wrong religion, have the wrong political ideas. And I think all of our attempts to break that isolation and speak out and associate are really important.
Mary Foster is an organizer with Project Fly Home. She was speaking on Tuesday at the Maritime Labor Center here in Vancouver. To learn more about Mr. Abdelrazzak's case and find out how to support him, go to peoplescommission.org. That's the website of a Montreal network monitoring and opposing the national security agenda.